97 years ago, the residents of Burnley were shocked to the core after one of the worst tragedies to befall them occurred on a wintry cold midday on the 21st of December 1923. Burnley Corporation Tram Car No. 10, which was being driven by 47-year-old William Norris, had been out in use over in nearby Rosegrove before making its return to Lane Head. It had been a relatively normal morning, and just like most other days, no issues with the tram car had been reported either prior to or leaving the depot or during its use that day. Norris had taken over the tram at around 11:15am at Duke Bar, Burnley, before making its way up towards Rosegrove, leaving the Burnley Centre for Howsike at around 11:55am. Outside, it had been a cold morning, with snow and ice patches forming on the roads, and Norris was aware of the risk posed to the tram car, and therefore, journeys between the stops had taken a little longer than normal due to the poor travelling conditions. Also out that day was 37-year-old Charles Lofthouse, a lorry driver working on behalf of haulage contractors, Messrs. John Stanworth and Brothers, and he himself had been having some issues with the ice conditions, also at times being delayed visiting the mills he was delivering to. Now approaching from the direction of Howsike, he was driving a wagon that was carrying a load of cloth weighing roughly 5 tonnes as he turned off Marsden Road and onto the incline on Briarcliff Road. It was just after noon and the area was becoming busy due to some children from nearby schools making their way to the stops to await the arrival of the tram car. Making its way slowly up Briarcliff Road and towards the junction leading onto Marsden Road, William Norris slowed the tram down as it approached what was known as the rollover. Coming in the opposite direction, Charles Lofthouse was making his way down the incline on the opposite side of the road. Knowing how poor the road conditions were, Lofthouse was intermittently pressing down on the brakes, trying to keep his wagon from gaining speed, but as the wagon and the tram car came within a few feet of each other, the rear of the wagon began to waver. Panicking, Lofthouse pressed down harder on the brakes, but it was too late. The wagon began to veer from side to side. Out of control, it collided with the tram, smashing into the cabin windows on the driver's right hand side. Glass shattered onto several of the passengers and a metal sidebar buckled with the impact. 6 bundles of cloth were flung from the wagon's flatbed as the vehicle shunted forward several feet before coming to a standstill, with one front wheel mounting a footpath and the other resting next to the curb. The impact was so strong that it had managed to push the tram backwards, which forced it to slowly roll back down the tracks. 2 of the passengers on board were those of Jenny Eastwood and Gracie Whittaker, both of whom were travelling on the lower deck. Immediately after the collision, Gracie shouted over to Jenny, "Come along, Jenny," but Jenny replied back, "No, I'm frightened." Norris then shouted to conductor William Simpson to "look after that child." Gracie took hold of Jenny's hand and together they quickly made their way over to Simpson. "Try and drop them with their faces upwards," Norris frantically shouted. Quickly, Simpson helped Gracie out of the tram, placing her on the ground outside, but it was too late to do the same with Jenny, as the tram had begun to pick up speed while making its way down Briarcliff Road, at one point travelling around 20 miles per hour. Norris began turning the tram car wheel to try and stabilise it using the rheostatic brakes, while Simpson was frantically kicking sand out onto the line in the hope of slowing it down. Now all tram cars at this time carried a load of sand, and this would be used to prevent slippage at starts or when on gradients. Norris, unable to do anything more in the driver's cabin, began to rush past the travelling passengers to help Simpson, who was now frantically trying to apply pressure to the brakes. "Make room for me at that end!" shouted Norris as he pushed by the startled passengers. At this point, a horse-drawn coal lorry driven by Mr. Thomas W. Atkinson was slowly making its way up towards Briarcliff Road, roughly 70 to 80 yards away, and he was heading directly into the path of the tram. Norris and Simpson had barely time to react, and as Norris reached the end of the tram where Williams was pulling hard on the brakes, the coal lorry was hurtled to one side as the tram smashed into the rear portion of it. Both men were thrown backwards and onto the floor from the impact of the collision. Norris was pinned next to the staircase with shattered glass now raining down on top of him. Simpson was in a similar position and with both men now unable to get back onto their feet, the tram was fully out of control. The tram and its passengers stood no chance. Careering further down the line until it reached a short bend and reaching a speed that was now approaching 40 miles per hour, it left the metal rails and toppled over onto its side, making a thunderous, crashing noise as it continued on its journey for a few more seconds before smashing into a corner shop on Segbird Street. The body of the tram was split into two and lay embedded in the window of Mr. Sunderland's shop, most of the woodwork completely smashed into pieces with a staircase and ironwork ripped from the supports. Utter carnage ensued, and as the many witnesses who had heard and saw the events unfold rushed to help all those on board, things would only get much worse. Henry Ashurst, an employee of the Burnley Corporation Tramways, had been a passenger on the tram as it made its way up towards Lane Head, but he had dropped off the tram whilst it was in motion only seconds before it had collided with the wagon. Seeing the tram beginning to roll back down Briarcliff Road, he realised a serious incident had occurred and hurriedly made his way down the road. He would see the tram topple over at the bend, leaving the rails and skidding into the shop at some speed. Rushing over to the scene of the accident, the first person he found on the wreckage was that of William Simpson, conductor, who was lying around 2 yards inside the tram. Ashurst assisted in removing Simpson from the wreckage, but in doing so he noticed the severe injuries to his legs. Simpson was still conscious but was in obvious pain. "Oh, my legs!" Simpson yelled at least 4 times when being lifted out of the debris. Meanwhile, Dr. Munro, who had been passing by after returning from Nelson and only a few minutes after the accident had occurred, quickly made his way to the horrific scene. Once there, he was asked to attend to a young girl by the name of Ethel Pomfret, who had been a passenger on the top deck of the tram. After making his way around to where the corner shot was and where the tram had impacted the most, he climbed the wreckage and was horrified to see the body of Ethel wedged between a portion of the tram and that of the building. It was instantly obvious to him that she was dead. Knowing there was nothing he could do to help the girl, he transferred all his energies into helping the other passengers of the tram, with William Simpson being the first survivor he would attend to. William had suffered serious injuries to both legs, with one almost being torn away from the limb. He was quickly released from the wreckage, but whilst he was conscious when being pulled from the wreck, he quickly became unconscious immediately afterwards. And at around 2:20 p.m, William's wife Amy went to Burnley Centre, hoping to see her husband pass through, but it was here she would be informed of the accident. She would make her way to Victoria Hospital to be with William, but upon her arrival a distressing scene was witnessed by many when the news was given to her that William had lost his battle and had died at around 1:20 p.m. And this was due to the severe wounds he had received, with loss of blood and shock being the main causes. The other passengers on that fateful morning were Elizabeth Meller, Ethel Heaton, Henry Whitehurst, Gracie Whittaker, Jenny Eastwood, Robert Thomas Foster, John Victor Pickles, Tom Greenwood, and a boy named Lever, as well as Henry Ashurst and, of course, driver William Norris. Out of the 13 people travelling on the tram, most managed to jump whilst it was travelling back down Briarcliff Road, and they would walk away relatively unscathed, albeit carrying a few cuts and bruises. However, driver William Norris, along with passengers Tom Greenwood, Jenny Eastwood, and John Victor Pickles, would all need to spend some time in hospital due to the severity of their injuries, mainly scalp wounds and all suffering from concussion. John Pickles had suffered perhaps the worst of the injuries as he sustained a fractured skull, and at the time it was doubtful that he would ever make a full recovery. But it goes without saying that the saddest part of this story is that of the two victims who had died that morning. Young Ethel Pomfret, who was just 14 years old and a pupil of Burnley High School, had lived at 31 Townley Street, Harrow Syke. She had boarded the tram and at once made her way up to the top deck, where she was accompanied by Tom Greenwood and John Pickles. Tall and well built for her age, with a fresh complexion and a mass of curly hair, her lively disposition made her a favourite of many of her friends, and in her 3rd year at school she was always cheerful and popular with all her classmates. Ethel was the only passenger to receive fatal injuries in the tram that morning, and it would take just over an hour to remove her body, such was the impact and the position her body was in. As for William Simpson, he was just 33 years of age and had lived with his wife Amy at number 57 Brockenhurst Street, Burnley, and he was popular amongst his work colleagues, as the turnout for his funeral would later prove. He would, at the upcoming inquiries, be relieved of any blame being attached to him for the loss of control of the tram, as several witnesses, including Harry Whitehurst, who was a passenger that morning, would later testify that William had done everything humanly possible to try and slow the tram down. He would also be credited with saving the lives of at least 2 children by getting them off the tram safely whilst it was making its way down the incline. Both Gracie Whittaker and a boy named Lever were seated in the tram when the collision first occurred, but William's quick thinking meant they would be safely removed without so much as a scratch. Now, the inquiry into the accident would formally take place on Friday the 4th of January 1924, with Lieutenant Colonel Mount, Inspector for the Ministry of Transport, visiting the site of the crash as well as the Queen's Gate tram depot, where he would inspect the remains of the tram. He would later in the day officially open the inquiry at Burnley Town Hall, but the proceedings would be done in private and later adjourned until Thursday the 17th of January. Now, an inquest would also take place on Wednesday the 9th of January, with a jury along with the Burnley Borough Coroner, Mr. A.F. Sutcliffe, spending from 9 o'clock in the morning until 7 in the evening going through the witness accounts, as well as visiting the scene of the accident and also visiting the Queensgate tram depot. In his address to the jury, the coroner will go over in detail, just as we have done, the events leading up to the accident. He would also speak of the witnesses who were first on the scene and who had tried to help the passengers, and just like Lieutenant Mount would do at his upcoming adjourned inquiry, he would also bring into question the use of skid chains on the wagon driven by Charles Lofthouse. And it seems that Lofthouse had originally put 2 skid chains on the vehicle after making his visits to nearby Nelson and Newchurch, but after the collision with the tram car, for some reason he took one of them off. The coroner would ask Lofthouse during the inquest, "Had you two chains on?" To which he replied, "Yes, one in each wheel." "Are you quite sure about what you are saying now?" asked the coroner. Loftus replied, "Yes, sir." He would also be asked when he had originally put the skid chains on his wagon, and he would say it was around 11:20 a.m. and after he had been in Nelson and over at Newchurch in Pendle. "Would you be surprised that the foreman of the jury says you had one chain and one rope, not two chains?" asked Mr. Lloyd, deputy town clerk. And Loftus again reiterated that two chains were on at first. It does seem Charles Loftus, for some reason, had removed one of the skid chains from a wheel after the accident and when the tram had left the lines further down the road. And instead of going down to help the passengers, he simply sat in the cab for over half an hour before taking one of the chains off. So the coroner asked Loftus, "What did you do then, whilst waiting in the cab for half an hour?" Loftus replied, "I took one of my skid chains off to help me get down to the bottom of the hill better. Then I came down to the scene of the accident." The jury would only spend a matter of minutes in deciding on their verdict, and upon returning into court, the verdict of accidental death would be made. The foreman would also say, "We exonerate the driver and the conductor from all blame. We think they did their very best for the passengers in the car." And interestingly, when asked about the driver of the wagon, the foreman said, "I may say we do not really believe there were any chains on the lorry." So the adjourned inquiry on the 17th of January would also focus on whether or not the wagon that had slid into the tram had been equipped with skid chains, and questions would also be asked as to how efficient the brakes on the tram had operated prior to and during the accident that took place that mid-afternoon. William Norris, who had left the Victoria Hospital on Saturday 12th of January, would take to the stand, and he would answer many questions relating to the use of the tram brakes in an emergency. He would go into great detail as to how the events unfolded on the 21st of December and how he had struggled to operate the braking mechanism due to it being dislodged due to the impact of the wagon. Lieutenant Colonel Mount would interrogate Norris several times over the course of an hour, but Norris would stick to his version of events, never changing his story despite what Mount would ask of him. And a letter written by a passenger would also be produced at the inquiry, praising Norris of his swift action on the 12th of December 1921, some 2 years prior to the events on Briarcliff Road, commending Norris for avoiding an accident. Now this will prove vital as it showed great experience when dealing with a similar incident. At the end of the inquiry, both Norris and Simpson would, just like at the inquest that took place on the 9th of January, be exonerated from any blame attached to the accident that took the lives of Ethel Pomfret and that of conductor Simpson, as well as seriously injuring several other passengers. They would be commended for the quick thinking and bravery in trying not only to bring the tram to a standstill, but also that of saving the lives of most of the passengers. As for Charles Loftus, he would try to explain away the reasoning why he took one of the skid chains off and why he waited for up to half an hour or more before making his way down the road to help those in need. He would also be questioned over the load he was carrying that morning and to whether or not he may have underestimated the weather conditions by having too much weight on the wagon. Lieutenant Colonel Mount put it to him that perhaps the weight he was carrying may have perhaps been a factor in him losing control of his wagon on the incline, and by pressing down on the brakes, his wagon veered from side to side. But in the end, none of this could be proven, and whilst the inquiry would lead to a final decision of accidental death, it seems Loftus would still perhaps be perceived as the one to blame, although no prosecutions would ever be made against him. Now interestingly, it seems Briarcliff Road and tram car number 10 had an history when it came to accidents taking place. On November 28, 1919, the tram, this time driven by William Fairclough, was ascending Briarcliff Road when it suddenly lost all control and slowly began making its way back down the incline. When it reached the curve, it toppled over, and luckily it wasn't travelling as fast as the incident in 1923, coming to a standstill almost as instantly as it toppled over. Four passengers were on board, whom have all survived, albeit with a few cuts and bruises, but one boy who was standing on the pavement sustained severe injuries but otherwise made a full recovery. Subsequent inquests would later find that cabling under the tram had given way, leading to all loss of control, with both driver and conductor being able to do nothing to prevent it from sliding back down the incline. William Simpson's funeral would take place on Wednesday, 26th of December 1923. The funeral cortege for the popular conductor was preceded by around 97 tramway and allied workers. They walked from his home in Brockenhurst Street before proceeding to the cemetery at Rosegrove, where he would later be interred. All along the route, houses had their blinds lowered as a mark of respect. As the cortege passed along Lyndhurst Road, Todmorden Road, Yorkshire Street and Accrington Road, hundreds of well-wishers all wanted to pay their last respects lowered their heads. The funeral ceremony throughout will be one of the most impressive witnessed in Burnley, and William's final resting place can be found using his grave marker, which is numbered as A7578. Ethel Pomfret's funeral would take place on December 27, 1923. Large crowds assembled to watch the departure of the funeral from 31 Townley Street to Worthorne Wesleyan Burial Ground, where interment would take place. Hundreds of mill workers all stayed away from work during the afternoon until they had witnessed the departure of the funeral, and had paid their respects by lowering blinds in all of their house windows along Halsyke. Men stood with their heads bowed as the procession passed by. Around 30 tramway men voluntarily attended the funeral and marched in front of the cortege up to Queen Victoria Road. Such was the outpouring of grief, the people of Briarcliff would fund a memorial to Ethel, which is a tall black marble tombstone that can still be found today lying in the bottom left-hand corner of the graveyard. On it, the inscription simply reads, "A rose transplanted." Sadly, Ethel's father Nicholas, who had brought up Ethel on his own after the death of his wife Jessie, who had passed away on the 25th of October 1916 when she was just 46 years old, himself would pass away 12 years later, aged just 56, and that was on the 1st of January 1935. He was never the same man again after losing his daughter. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story, and if you want more, please show some support and comment down below. You can also now listen to these stories on most well-known podcast platforms, as well as over on our YouTube channel, links of which can be found down below. You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram. Again, links are down below. But in the meantime, take care, and I'll be back soon with another tale from the past.